Hi all, this is Dan Airy. It's Monday, December 3rd, 2019. Merry Christmas and welcome to Windchill Time.
Happy holidays, happy Kwanzaa, happy Hanukkah, happy Festivus for the rest of us.
Yeah, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Airy, you don't have to do it. I see you raising the notes. Let's go ahead and roll Matt. Hold on. No, seriously, we're going to roll Matt. I got a new intro for us.
Ooh.
Yes. All right. Welcome to Windchill Time, y'all. Thanks for tuning in. This podcast is non-technical, fun, informative way to learn about money, Bitcoin, blockchains, crypto, and digital assets for busy parents and working folks who are curious about these new technologies. Day, Airy, and their guests talk about these evolutionary systems of money and what they do, y'all. Because what part of your life does money not touch? This podcast is not financial advice, and your reactions are your total and complete responsibility, y'all. Now, thanks again, and enjoy the show.
Oh, my God, that was awesome. Thanks, Matt. I don't have to read anymore. We have a professional. Thank you, Matt.
Yeah, so that's going to be our new intro for a while. We might mix it in with some live stuff, live readings of the, you know, the introduction of Windchill Time here and there, but that's pretty much set for the new year. It's permanent until further notice.
Hee-haw.
Yeah. All right, my name is Day. I'm a co-host, past sales engineer working on wide area networks and now working with Airy.
And I'm Airy. I'm the co-host of Windchill Time, currently the chair of the Cascadia Blockchain Council powered by the WTIA.
Shout out again to Matt Case. He's going to be joining us on this journey here for what we're calling Windchill Time. Been doing it about 6 months now, and so we're partnering up with him more formally, especially on the YouTube channel. And as a note, please, I'll put a link to the new YouTube channel that we created, and mm-hmm. if we get a subscription, that would help us out a ton and be able to spread the good word of Bitcoin, crypto, digital assets,
money,
and all
investing.
That stuff, money investing. Not financial advice to the masses.
And if you also want to hear Matt Case during the day between 9 and 3 p.m., I was just hearing him as I was driving back. He's on 95.7 The Jet.
So he has the best variety of 80s and more. Yeah. And that's you can actually get that anywhere in the world through the iHeart Radio app. So you just go to iHeart Radio, and then Windchill Time is also a podcast that you can listen to there. And you can go to 95.7 The Jet and listen to local Seattle, you know, Pacific Time, you know, live radio.
It's an awesome radio station, though. Yeah, it's an awesome radio station. All right, so how are you, Day?
I'm doing pretty good. I was doing a little test audio, and it seems like I finally got my voice back. It was about 2 months now, so end of October, we were in Las Vegas, which is where the recording of this interview that we're about to present with Charles Hoskinson of Cardano. Mm-hmm. Lost my voice shortly after that trip, and I've had sinus issues, all kinds of stuff, and I think I'm finally back and normal. It only took 2 months.
Just in time for the holidays.
Just in time to lose it all again for the holidays. Christmas and New Year's.
Yeah, I'm doing great, too.
How are you doing? Yes.
I'm doing great, too.
You're doing great. Can you give me a little detail?
Since we've been traveling the last 10-plus days, just now hurrying
up. Feels like a while.
Yeah, it's like forever. So the home is in disarray. We're trying to do laundry, unpack, get the house settled for the in-laws and parents and extended family to land in the home tomorrow. And I got to cook the ham and the beef stuff and all that. So a lot of scrambling today, but feeling like, oh, I'm going to wrap all the presents too. So you're going to be helping me wrap a lot of presents today.
I'm an excellent present wrapper. I should have worked at
the
mall
as a
teenager.
Yeah, it's just a lot of people to take care of. So, yep, that's
it. All right, let's do some Satoshi math. And oh, by the way, this is my commitment to try. I'm going to try my darndest to create a page on our windchilltime.studio, www.windchilltime.studio page, to be able to plug in two numbers, the number of dollars and the current price of Bitcoin, and be able to spit out the number of sats. I think I've seen other websites try it. I don't like how any other websites have tried to do that math. And so I think I'm going to try that.
Good luck with that.
It's an easy calculation.
You should
just call it
Satoshi Math.
Yeah, yeah. The page. That's what the page is going to be called, Satoshi Math. Yeah.
Anyway.
December 23rd again, Monday 2019, and the price of Bitcoin on my handy-dandy Apple stocks quoting app, BTC-USD, was at 7,000.
$462.
Oh, not bad. Still holding steady.
And how do you convert that into sats, Ari?
Well, to figure out how many Satoshis are in one U.S. dollar, you take the number one to represent one U.S. dollar and divide it by the number of Bitcoin, the U.S. dollars in Bitcoin, decimalized eight places out. So it's one divided by 0.0007462. And you get, drum roll,
it's 13,400 sats. 13,401 sats.
Wow, time to stack sats.
Yeah, well above the $10,000 sats per dollar benchmark.
Cool. Have people been pinging you to buy Bitcoin or figuring how to buy Bitcoin? Is it happening right now because it's the end of the year? Or do you have a sense?
So that's a good segue into the CNN article that came out in the last week or so. The CNN article quoted a study of some kind. I think it was done by Bank of America, quoting the best and worst investments of the last decade.
Because Evil Bank we are, of America.
Yes, because we are, you know, at the end of 2019.
Mm-hmm.
And excitingly enough, they quoted Bitcoin as the best investment of the decade, where you could have turned $1 into $90,000. Good sound effect.
Wow, I wish. I can only wish.
Yeah.
For those people that started way early in like 2009 and 10 that were doing those GPU gaming optimization with hardware and stuff, like Christy Lee Minahan told us, I can only imagine.
They could have done well. They probably didn't hold on, but a few of them might have.
Who knows?
A few hodlers out there.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so it quoted, and then so I've been getting a few pings actually from old colleagues and friends about how to buy Bitcoin, and I realized that it's all second nature to me, but there are, you know, easily half a dozen very well-known consumer ways to purchase Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty of consumer choice out there. There's prosumer choices out there as well. Happy to help out anybody who wants to reach out to me at Luggage Donkey on Twitter, but you know, if they're seeing this stuff and seeing the stuff I'm posting on LinkedIn, then they probably can call me or message me or DM me or something like that directly anyway, because they already know me.
I wonder if we could just do like a podcast episode on how to buy Bitcoin. Like we go and try a CoinMe, Coinstar, ATM, and we like talk about it as we do it. And then we try and transact and set up a new Coinbase account. And we like say, oh, got to pause here. We'll come back in 10 days because they're still doing the KYC. And come back in 10 days. Apparently it's still not done.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
And then you just like put music segments in between the different ways to buy Bitcoin.
It'll take a whole lot of editing, a whole lot of editing.
But I know you can do it.
Well, so before we wrap up this introduction here, so a preview into what we're about to hear, Ari and I were really fortunate enough to meet up with Charles Hoskinson at CoinMe, Litecoin Summit, WCC,
Coin Agenda.
Did I say CoinMe?
Yeah.
Sorry. And so it was a trifecta, at least, of conferences going on around Halloween this past October. And we got a chance to sit down with Charles Hoskinson. Some of the topics we'll cover that I thought was interesting was we kicked it off, no pun intended. I didn't realize until I was editing the show last night that I kicked it off asking him about his boots.
Oh,
his
cowboy
boots. Yeah.
He has a thing for cowboy boots because I remember back in 2017, followed him around the world to try and meet up with him many, many times, you know, Athens, London. We even did like Aspen, Miami, etc. And he'd always have these fancy boots. He'd be like, hey, I got some new boots. And I'm like, wow, it's really hot. Because when I saw him in Athens, it was like 95, 100 degrees outside. We're walking for 9 hours straight because we arrived on a Sunday and everything was closed. And he's wearing full long sleeve shirt, pair of long jeans, and these really, really thick cowboy boots, plus a hat on top. And me, like, I'm like taking off stuff, and I basically have a tunic on only and a pair of ankle boots, and I was still dying of heat exhaustion. I just don't know how he did it, but 9 hours
That's
walking around
uniform.
Athens. Yeah, it's amazing.
That's his standardized universal global uniform.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we kicked it off. No pun intended, but it turned out to be a good pun about talking about his cowboy boots.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, basic stuff like what is Cardano? And the answer is it's a financial operating system, which I think is, you know, if anybody uses a computer, it has an operating system. Well, Cardano is a financial operating system for big organizations like governments and enterprises. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And then another good word that we talked about was trans-sovereign. Remember that?
No.
So it's a word that I had not heard before, but just like if you take the word transfer, so you take it from one place, you take something from one place to another, then we're talking about regulatory environments and you know, rules and regulations that can go from one know, sovereign nation to another, and that is what trans-sovereign means. So I thought that was a fun new word.
Just because Charles is so well educated about the space because he's been working on it for so long. And we saw him also, remember, at the Wyoming Stampede where he brought the idea of the contingent settlement. I think he's been talking to so many different heads of state and governments and, you know, talking about financial systems that, you know, he's seeing a solution or an opportunity to for these trans-sovereign use cases. And we just have to help the governments and the rest of the people kind of catch up to all the learning and talking and educating that he's already done to date, you know, forever.
Because we're so deep in all of this, it feels like it moves really slowly. But in actuality, there's a lot of work being done simultaneously by all kinds of organizations everywhere. And so it's nice to get a reminder of that based on, you know, Charles's experience and who he's been talking to and, you know, the work that he's been doing.
I love the way he speaks. Some of my favorite people, just like Charles Hoskinson, they have a way with words and sentences. And he spoke very eloquently, if you noticed that too. He has a way of speaking in prose.
Yeah, yeah. He's a great, great conversationalist and great talker, yeah.
And then he also does a really great job of bringing real stories to what he's talking about. So he'll talk about something that's very complicated, potentially, and goes over most people's heads, but the way he explains it and the ordering in which he explains it with the simplicity, it's always just so clarifying after talking to him.
Awesome. So let's see here. So again, quick reminder, please, I'll put a hyperlink to our YouTube channel in the show notes. Please subscribe. Help us out a little bit. Yeah, it'll help us get a customized YouTube URL instead of having all that gobbledygook characters and numbers and all that kind of stuff that just really is unattractive. And fair warning for this show, the audio is terrible. When I was editing last night, there's packing tape in the background.
Oh, that guy was so annoying.
There's packing tape. There's just all kinds of noise and conversation. Most of what Charles says is audible and legible, but a lot of what you and I say is hardly actually hearable.
Oh.
And so I'm going to try to do some more editing magic to clean that up a little bit. But, I mean, what's really important is what Charles is saying anyway. So please excuse the not great audio, but, you know.
It'll be like you're sitting right there in the middle of the Las Vegas, Cosmopolitan Hotel, as we're in the midst of Coin Agenda Global Conference.
Yes, exactly. All right. So thanks to our sponsors, CoinMe. I accidentally slipped up and mentioned them in the earlier part here, but it's the best cash to Bitcoin on-ramp and basically any grocery store. Like I said, I was messing around with on Twitter with Mark Cuban about going and buying some Bitcoin at the grocery store.
Because they just opened up Dallas.
Yes, they just opened up Dallas, exactly. Also, CoinMe has...
Oh, yeah, they have private client services. So if you actually want to talk to a human, they have a whole customer support team. And if you want to buy Bitcoin like today, it's actually the fastest way to get into Bitcoin. Most of the other on-ramps, you have to actually do your KYC and AML, and then you have to do your bank transfer, and usually it takes at least 10 to 15 days. But if you want to buy Bitcoin today, just call up the CoinMe private client services, and they can actually take you from having no Bitcoin to some Bitcoin in 24 hours. So highly recommend them. Brent and Brian, really, really great guys. I see them and talk to them. And they're real people.
Yes, exactly. Brent and Brian, shout out to you guys. Appreciate everything that you do.
And then finally, thanks to our sponsor, the WTIA, the Washington Technology Industry Association, representing over 1,100 technology companies in the Pacific Northwest, aka the Cascadia region. And they help us create one collective voice as we talk to policymakers, innovators, and investors in the region.
Awesome. Again, thanks again to Matt Case. Shout out to Matt Case for creating our brand new intro that we'll use for a while, and going to enjoy working with you in the new year and creating some awesome content, not only on YouTube, but also in this podcast.
Thanks for being our new bug.
New bug on the windshield. All right. Thanks, y'all. Be nice.
Together we rise. Bye.
So thank you, Charles, for sitting down with us. I want to kick off by going ahead and jumping into the boots. So I've seen you a number of times now. Mm-hmm. And you have these awesome boots you wear. Mm-hmm. So is there a story behind why you wear boots?
I'm kind of a guy that worships practicality and simplicity wherever possible. And Steve Jobs years ago, he wanted people at Apple to actually wear uniforms. And so he said, the turtleneck is the perfect thing to do. So he bought hundreds and hundreds of these black turtlenecks and tried to make everybody at Apple wear them. Yeah, they wouldn't do it. So he just kept them and he said, well, screw it, I'm just going to wear them every day. You know, maybe if I do it, everybody else will start following me. And that became his trademark look. You know, for me, I love jeans and they're super easy, and a collared shirt is basically good everywhere. And I was looking for a universal shoe. Yeah, because a boot is both formal and informal. It's comfortable, you can wear it anywhere, but you also can take it into meetings and things like that. The other thing is you can really diversify on the boot. Like, you can make it of all kinds of exotic leathers. Like, so the one I have on right now is made out of stingray. I have crocodile, alligator. You can even do elephant, although I'd never buy one of those poor elephants. But it's pretty amazing what you can do with boots. So I just love them. I think they're the perfect piece of footwear. Also, I can have them custom made. So I suffer from gout, and after I had a really bad gout attack, my right foot got a little bit bigger than my left foot, and so it made it a little difficult to get normal shoes. And so I can have
such a very common physiological issue, foot being larger.
Exactly, exactly. And normally speaking, you can have the same size shoe, but the issue is if it's slightly larger, then it creates back issues or all kinds of things. And so your boot's custom made, it's like everything just fits and it just works. Plus, in a fight, you can just throw them at people. They're pretty heavy.
I was shocked to learn a few years ago that they're actually, they can be really expensive, like in the thousands of dollars.
Okay. Yeah, I have one pair that's $6,000.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah,
fancy watch.
It's a custom-made Lucchese's, yeah. But, they're actually great value for the money.
John Wayne. Is that the brand that John Wayne?
Lucchese's? Yeah, I think he did.
Okay,
he did. But what's nice about Lucchese's is you can send it back to Lucchese's and they rebuild the boot for about $200. So you basically get a new boot when you come back. So you buy this $6,000 boot, you have it for 30 years, and so your cost per year over a long period of time is pretty low. You just have to have it rebuilt about once a year. And it's not too bad.
Thoughts on that, Ari?
I might have to relook at how I invest in shoes.
Oh, women have so many options there. It's crazy. They're just absolutely crazy. All the different designs they have.
90% of them are not comfortable. I bet boots are comfortable.
Yeah, boots are so comfortable.
When I first met you, in Athens, Greece, and we walked forever. I was dying because remember I had to stop in between and buy flip-flops because my shoes could not take it.
Uh-huh.
But you just kept on going in those boots.
Yeah. Yeah, Greece is not forgiving those streets.
No. I was sweating. I remember. And when we finally sat down to eat, I was like...
So for our listeners, the background story is that Ari actually met Charles on her international adventures during her experience with a previous company. And so the relationship has just basically grown, and we've run into each other several different places. San Francisco was, I think, the first time I met you.
Right. We went to that. We went to that one seafood restaurant. No, it was a bar actually.
It was a bar. Yeah. It was nicely empty.
A nicely empty bar. Talk. Exactly.
We had a double date.
Yeah, it was great. It was great.
And then we saw you in Wyoming recently.
That was a lot of fun too. I really do enjoy Wyoming.
Yeah.
What'd you guys think?
There's so much land. It was just really big. The amenities like taxis and Ubers are not as plentiful. But the people are very nice.
What did you think of the conference?
It was really good. The conference was really nice and very intimate. Because
right.
You get to really get to hear people and see people, talk to people. And everyone was really excited because we brought our baby. So
right.
Everyone was holding the baby, I remember.
Yeah, it's Bitcoin
a,
baby.
Yeah, it's a crypto baby.
Crypto baby.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's jump into crypto and Bitcoin.
Absolutely.
So do you think that we'll kind of move into this phase where we'll start calling it digital assets instead of crypto?
Yeah, everybody's searching for an acronym or some term, right? You know, now I guess DeFi is the latest thing. DeFi, that's the sexy term of the week, right? You know, decentralized finance. But yeah, there's cryptocurrencies, crypto assets. There's security tokens now, whatever the hell that is. It's hard to know what the terminology is going to be, and they kind of go through trends. But at some point, we'll settle on a term, and I'll just adopt the term and put it into my lexicon. But what I care more about are the principles of the system, because regardless of what you call them, they're always basically the same thing. You're talking about the quantification of trust, you're talking about the movement of value, you're talking about contractual relationships between people, and you're talking about this notion that it's all the functionality is pushed to the edges. So you don't go through middlemen, you actually have a direct commercial relationship, legal relationship, property relationship with somebody at the edges. So from that perspective, that's the stuff that has to be preserved and understood. And people have to be able to heuristically distinguish between a system that has those properties and some that tries to have those properties, but in reality is actually controlled by curators.
Why is this important? So, for someone that isn't exposed to the world of policy and technology and money and investing and all this stuff, like why is it important to have a direct commercial relationship, for instance?
The issue here is that we're living in the world of big data, we're living in the world of services, and we're living in the world of middlemen. Like, everything is now a platform and it is a middleman. Like, Facebook is a platform and it's a middleman. LinkedIn is a platform, it's a middleman. eBay is, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the people who occupy those roles have enormous power because they can start setting prices, they own all your data, they can decide who's a marketplace participant. Like, for example, for content producers, they go to YouTube and they now have to live in YouTube's world. And we'd like to say we have freedom of speech, but then suddenly they say the wrong thing, they get deplatformed, like Sargon or these other people. And so when you start seeing the deplatforming happening, economic inclusion being restricted, or certain market segments be delegitimized, let's say you're a marijuana grower or something like that, it's really a bad deal when only a small group of actors get to make those decisions, and they're not bound by public policy or constitutional protections. They're not bound by your desires, they're bound by their commercial obligations, especially when those platforms compete against you. So for example, look at Disney. They've created this huge IP platform, and now they're saying, hey, maybe we should do content distribution as well. That's not so good for Hulu and Netflix and all these other guys, because they basically will lose Star Wars and the Marvel portfolio and all these other things as a consequence of this massive portfolio. So wherever possible that you can democratize things and push control to the edges, then it says you can just be yourself, you can say the things you want to say, buy the things you want to say, and you don't have to be afraid that at some point that will be politically unpopular and you get cut off. In the Western world, maybe it's an annoyance for a small group of creative people on the edges. In the Eastern world, especially China, it's a matter of survival, especially with the dawn of social credit. I mean, there's a master plan in China over the next 10 years of taking the recent digital currency that they're creating and the social credit infrastructure they're building and the surveillance infrastructure they have and tethering it all together into one homogeneous system. And then that system will basically put a number on everybody's forehead. And if your number is really high, you're a good citizen, you get the good wife, cheap airline tickets. If your number is really low, you get exiled and actually you become a pariah because people are not allowed to actually associate with you. If they associate with you, it lowers their number. So you become basically untouchable. So you can't really allow economic systems to become victims of algorithms, big data, and middlemen. And the whole point of our movement is saying there is an alternative where we get all the utility and things that we've known to love with the Facebooks and the YouTubes and the Amazons, but we don't actually have to have a company governing that. It can actually be us collectively working together to create this multi-sided marketplace. It's going to take a while to get there, but I think it's, philosophically speaking, one of the most important fights of the 21st century.
So we recently went to Los Angeles for this conference called Bitcoin Is, which is hosted by Russell Kung, the NFL football player who recently found out about Bitcoin and this world of cryptocurrencies. So we brought our friend. She was titled the rookie. Like, she knew nothing. So she went to this conference and she learned about it. And one of her questions was, all right, so I see like this future state and there's a lot of like social benefit, especially if you look at it globally, but I can't really bridge the gap of like how we're gonna get there, and like I don't really feel safe because I don't know what that experience is gonna be like, and how do I know what's next and what to do next? I know where I'm supposed to be going, but I don't know how to get there.
Yeah, so the point of protocols is they're composable and they're layered. And so the first thing is you want to create open protocols that are universal and they're permissionless and people anywhere in the world are free to use them without fear. But then what happens is entrepreneurs come in at the application layer and they construct great user experiences that have consumer protection. And they kind of work their way backwards to the kinds of things they need to have to both be viral and useful to people. So a wonderful example would be we just recently did a pilot with New Balance where they have a very particular problem. They sell these high-value shoes and sneakerheads love buying them. Unfortunately, there's a lot of counterfeiting that occurs. They, in fact, last year they confiscated about 25 million shoes, just New Balance. And that's only probably a small percentage of the overall total amount of counterfeits in circulation. And every time that occurs, it damages your brand identity. Like, imagine if you're Rolex and they're facing this terrible statistic that 9 out of 10 Rolexes are counterfeit. So if you see somebody with that watch on, more often than not, it's fake than real. So would you really want to go spend $30,000 on a watch when everybody's going to think that the watch isn't real? You know, it hurts their brand. It hurts their sales. So they come to us and they say, hey, can we work out a solution where we can create a blockchain-based product, in this case it's deployed on Cardano, that can help us start taking a chunk out of the authentication problem and strengthen our brand and help the secondary market and a litany of other things over a long arc. Well, in practice, when we built this application, we flew to Los Angeles for the launch party. We were at the New Balance store right there in LA, and we saw all these sneakerheads go and buy their shoes, and they had their little authentication card. They had no idea they were using a cryptocurrency. They had no idea they were using Cardano. It was just to them a certificate of authenticity and a cell phone application. And
that's actually a critical portion, obfuscating, you know, obscuring this whole crypto stuff to users in the future.
The technology has to fade into the back, and you have to focus on the experience and the utility, and it just has to be magical for the consumer. It just has to work. They don't need a lot of choices. They just need something to solve their problem. And if you do a great job with the technology, it seamlessly fades into the back. It doesn't get in the way. So I get asked all the time, when will we have mass adoption? I think it's the wrong question. I think the question is, when will the technology get out of the way and become seamless? And we're getting there very slowly. And the good news is there's very strong financial incentives to do this. Because every time you solve one of these problems, you create new marketplaces, new market opportunities, and the entrepreneurs who solve that make money. So whenever you see trends where people can make money for doing the right thing, that bodes very well for society or for technology.
Mm-hmm. So if we keep our sort of listener audience in mind, typical working folks, not technical, if you had to give an elevator pitch about Cardano, then how would you do that?
I often say Cardano is the financial operating system for those who don't have one. And what I mean by that is if you're born into a society like the United States or the European Union or Japan or Korea, you already kind of have a lot of things figured out in terms of how your money works, how your banking system works, how exchanges work. Like if you want to invest, you kind of know how to do that. You know who to talk to. There's exchanges. If you want to start a company, there's well-formed venture capital marketplaces. If you know you want to go ahead and send a wire transfer to somebody, it's a fairly straightforward process. You know, these things exist. But then when you go, for example, to Ethiopia, these are high growth economies that are very young. 70% of the country is at or under the age of 30. And most of the people there really don't like their marketplace, and everything is just a pain. Paying a utility bill can take hours. Getting money in and out of the country can take days, weeks, months, and be very expensive, in some cases 15% for a transaction. And they don't have a stock market. So what happens if you create a great Ethiopian company, you're making lots of money, you have no liquidity for your investors. Your only option is to leave the country and do a reverse merger in South Africa or the Caribbean or something like that. So they say, well, at some point they're going to wake up and build their own financial systems, and then it's the same analogous problem that they had when Pakistan, for example, had to build a phone infrastructure. Do they go and put copper wire into the ground and install and dig millions of miles of this cable, or do they just put up 4G towers? Right? So they chose the 4G towers. And so it's the same situation here. They don't have to replicate the American financial system. They can have a completely different financial operating system. And the pitch we're making for Cardano is we can do everything the legacy system can do, but we can do it in a more automated way with more control to the edges in a much more globalized compatible way and in a way that allows them to upgrade at a lower cost. and still get all the benefits that we get in America or people get in Korea or people get in the European Union. So it's a tremendously challenging task, and there's a lot of things to think about. There's a lot of moving pieces. But when you get it right, it just works. And it works for everybody, not just for one group of people. The other thing is that these marketplaces lack credibility. Well, you know, there's all these investors in America, brilliant investors, and we say, hey, we got this African company we'd like to, for you to invest in. And it may have great prospects. But then people, oh, I got burned. I invested in Africa before, and I ran into this problem with the government, and I'm not a big company, so I can't get recourse. It's very difficult. If you actually read Bob Iger's biography, he was talking about his challenges opening up Shanghai Disneyland. And the guy he was negotiating with was banished for corruption to northern China and delayed the project for 2 years. This is a big company like Disney, and even they were having to deal with these problems. So normal investors, they just say, I don't have the ability to do that. So a lot of these African countries or developing countries are desperate for something to give them international credibility and rule of law. So they've changed their legal systems, they've changed their course, they've combated corruption, but they need additional competitive advantages to bring direct foreign investment to the country and create liquidity for the countries. So blockchain solutions are extremely appealing because they're saying, hey, even if you don't trust us, we can't just go steal your assets. You can liberate those assets and they're not subject to your capital controls or things like that. So those two components together are kind of the design space of Cardano. One is look at where we were in the past, but make it more global, make it faster, make it more decentralized. And the other side is make these things trans-sovereign, make these things truly global. The internet's truly global. It doesn't belong to any country. So let's make markets that are truly global. And these are the things that we're thinking about trying to solve with Cardano and from a kind of a surface level.
So, like, we're going towards a trans-sovereign, trans-global world.
This is the first time I actually heard that term, trans-sovereign. Because right. All I hear about is non-sovereign. Non-sovereign.
Right.
Because trans-sovereign is very important.
Yeah, the governments aren't going to go away. I mean, you're always going to have governments around in some form or fashion. It's just a question of how do they cooperate with each other. And this is why society's starting to get a little hairy, because we have these giant collective action problems, whether it be global warming or global financial regulation or armed conflict. And we don't really have good structures at the moment to resolve these things, because the prior structures were very simple. There was, we're going to have a big war, somebody's going to win it, and the person who wins the war is the empire, and then that empire sets all the standards. So the 20th century was ruled by America. We, you know, it was either us or the Soviets. We won that fight, and so basically everybody adopted our banking system. The dollar is the reserve currency. Our regulatory system became basically the de facto world regulatory system. In the 19th century, they had the British Empire and the French, and you know, you can just look at any period of history, and there was always some dominant force for their geopolitical region that standardized everything. Now we've moved to the 21st century and we're in the information economy, and nobody really wants to have World War III, and nobody really wants to announce a winner and say this is the empire that runs everything. So then how do we get beyond that and negotiate something? And so we need different tools, and you can either create a giant meta-government like, well, you know, what the EU is trying to do or some UN mandates are trying to do, or you can try a different approach. And what blockchain's basically doing is saying it's bottom-up instead of top-down. It's saying that you don't really need a CEO or a leader or a committee. You're just going to create the incentives in the right way and create the interactions in the right way. And then there's this emergent complexity that grows out of the system that actually solves the problems you want to solve. You know, kind of like nobody runs a rainforest. Nobody runs an ecosystem. Yeah, you know, it just, all these animals came together, all these plants came together, and then suddenly it just started reaching a steady state, and that state is very resilient. So even if a fire breaks out or a species goes extinct, the rainforest is, generally speaking, very solid. We're really bad as humans at building sustainable, resilient structures. We usually do the wrong thing. We optimize these structures. And so the optimization means that we lower the cost and everything gets, you know, really fast and efficient. But then the minute that the model's wrong, everything comes shattering apart. For example, the 2008 financial crisis. Everybody was trading with the same models. Everybody was using the same assets. And while that was good, it was really good. Everybody was making windfall money. And when that was bad, it got really, really bad. You want your markets, you want your government, you want your international trade to be much more resilient. You want a situation where if a country collapses or a market collapses, it doesn't destroy the entire global economy and so forth. So this is the big challenge of the 21st century, is how do you achieve that without having a big war, or how do you achieve that without just declaring a winner? And how do you achieve that in a way that is very resilient? And I think this is the greatest contribution our technology has to that collective action problem.
This new trans-sovereign future that's being created as we speak, thanks to like technologies like Cardano, I can see the developing nations, like African nations like Ethiopia that you mentioned, embracing this. But what about the big nations like the United States? Like, how is this going to really work? Because the United States is resistant to it. Or do you think the United States will embrace it eventually?
Right. Because we just got through, from recent events, we just got through the hashtag Shiboom, Xiboom, after he announced, oh, we're going to embrace blockchain.
Right.
It's really nebulous, but then, of course, Bitcoin ran up like $2,500 in one day.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
the Shiboom. Yeah, poor Winnie the Pooh. But anyway.
Comes to the U.S.
Well, I think it's all about incentives. So nobody changes if they don't have an incentive to change. You know, the reality is that if you look at like newspapers, for example, or if you look at the horse and buggies and so forth, nobody went to them and said, "Hey, you know, we have this new business model we're thinking about, and this business model is awesome. So why don't you just stop doing what you're doing and just convert over to us?" They laugh at you. They say, "No, we like our business. We like our monopoly. Life is good." But then technology comes, and it's almost like a law of physics. You get out innovated. They're operating at significantly, their cost structure is more efficiency. Things are considerably better. And so you have to either change or die. So what we need to do is we need to go to the developing world, and they haven't made any choices about what financial system they're going to plug into, but they have to because of globalization. I'll give some examples of that in a little bit. But they have to, so if they go to our system, they'll just be better than our system. And collectively, they'll make a lot more money, and collectively, they'll have a lot more wealth.
The
U.S. system.
Oh, you mean the U.S. system?
For example. And so then the U.S. system will have to look at itself and take that cold look in the mirror. It's kind of like when your girlfriend leaves you and you're like, man, what should I change about myself? Maybe I should go to the gym a little bit. You know, you have that moment, very depressing moment in the apartment. Anyway, you go on the diet and everything, right? So that change the laws, embrace the technology, and so forth. So every country runs into these things, and the Soviet Union for a long time tried to legislate economic growth. They said, we have these great plans, but the reality is you can't through a ballot box and you can't through government fiat legislate success. It's just not possible. You can pass as many laws as you want, but if your markets are not structured properly, you will lose. So the key here is to get some markets structured properly and have those markets succeed and make lots of money. And then the CEOs running these big Western companies will say, why are we getting screwed? We're getting our lunch taken. And then they'll put enormous political pressure on the U.S. system to change and adapt and embrace this new technology. Or if they don't, just like the newspapers, they go out of business. They just start falling apart economically. And then the people say, but what's the incentive for these developing world countries to adopt this new technology? Well, it's being forced on them. For example, if you are in the agricultural business, let's say you make coffee beans, when Starbucks comes to you and says, we want to verify that your coffee is fair trade certified, and we want to verify that your coffee is made with sustainable farming practices and carbon reduction and blah, 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 you have to actually verify that. And then you look at it, you're on a paper-based social system, people are putting beans on the back of donkeys, it's not really high tech. So you say, oh, wow, we need a whole new system to actually figure this out. Oh, well, I guess we need a national identity system. Oh, I guess we need a whole supply chain management system. Oh, God, we need payment infrastructure. Oh, we have to redo the way we do subsidies. So when you start working your way backwards from that very simple request, you have two options. Either you upgrade and go to a completely modernized economy, or you now lose market access to this huge buyer. For example, Walmart just passed, asparagus, it was one of the vegetables in their portfolio. They had salmonella problems, and so they created a blockchain system, and they mandated that their growers have to plug into the system. The growers did not want to adopt it, but do they want to lose a client of that size and prominence? No, you just do what they tell you to do. So this is what I say when globalization is being forced on these countries, and so they now have to make these decisions, and if they make them correctly, collectively they'll be in a significantly more competitive economic state. And then that will force change upon the developed world, upon America and the European Union and China. And if we don't change, well, we'll lose. Mm-hmm. And then we'll be the poor country and they'll be the rich country.
For the average American who's not in the technology field, so school teacher, construction worker, waiter, bartender. Mm-hmm. Like, this future's coming, and it seems so cool and so awesome. And yes, I want to embrace and I want to be a part of it, but how do I make sure that I also have a place in it for me and my family and my generations? Mm-hmm. What should I be doing today, and how should I be thinking about it? Like, I can't buy a whole Bitcoin, so maybe I'll buy $5 or $20 of it, but what else?
I think as a technologist or an entrepreneur, I'm asking the wrong question if I'm saying, like, how do I get mom and pop involved? No, nobody in the cell phone space, like Apple, didn't wake up and say, oh, how do we get mom and pop involved with mobile computing, right? Or app development or something. No, they just built the iPhone and they said, here's this great consumer experience that's amazing and it solves all these problems that you really would like to solve. Like, you'd like to navigate with it, you'd like to go watch videos with it, or, you know, take pictures or whatever. And I say, wow, that's so cool. And just by people buying that, suddenly you built an ecosystem, and then people could build on top of that ecosystem and keep adding more experiences. For example, greatest example of that, just small example, but it's a beautiful example, is the flashlight app on your phone. That was not invented by Apple or Google. It initially came from an app developer who said, we could use the flash and just turn it on, run it, because it's an LED, and now you have a flashlight. And now it's built into my Samsung S10. It's built into most cell phones because it's just a good idea, right? So you have this beautiful consumer-driven innovation. So it's the same with the blockchain space. You know, for the most part, us companies like IOHK, we build infrastructure. So we wake up every day and we ask the science questions and the committee questions, and we wonder where the world is going, and we make bets about what technology we feel is going to be great. And then entrepreneurs wake up and they take that stuff that we've created, some cases us included, and they build great experiences to solve particular problems, verticals, like maybe the New Balance thing, or, you know, our currency or something like that. And when we get it right, the consumer gets a great experience, and that's where they usually participate. Now, a lot of people say, well, hang on a second here. These protocols are kind of like ETFs on the future. It's almost as if I could get an equity share or something in the Apple App Store. Would you buy shares in that, right? It's like, in the beginning, yeah, that's really cool. So from that particular perspective, these tokens do represent that. They represent the total aggregate consumption of the entire system. So if you want to get involved in that, my recommendation is first just really understand the technology, the purpose of the technology well. And if you do an Amazon search, there's dozens of good books like Digital Gold and Age of Cryptocurrency and some recent ones that have been written that give a pretty fair and balanced view of the point of the technology, the history of the technology, and why we do what we do and who's doing good stuff. And then and only then, after you've done that, the next step is diversification. The reality is that you can break the sector down into many different segments and basically just buy a portfolio of them. Don't ever put everything into one. But, you know, that's investment advice, and I don't do that.
We don't give investment advice here either. Yeah. Official time.
Yeah, you know, it's more of just use common sense, right? Understand what you're doing, like Warren Buffett does, and then just basically diversify your bets, and you'll probably bet on something, right, if you think this is actually the real deal and it's going to move. But we don't need that for these technologies to be successful. What we need is natural demand. We need consumers to use these technologies to solve real problems, and just by doing that, it creates a lot of demand on the system, which increases the value of the system to society.
We did a really short interview with Tim Draper, the legendary Tim Draper, and so he had a really interesting take. He said, you know, when you talk to your friends and family, just tell them that it's just like buying like a yen or like a euro or, you know, like another currency.
Right.
Think of it like that, frame it like that, and, you know, it maybe won't seem so scary.
Right, but it's not an accurate analogy, though. That's the problem, because, you know, you say yen or dollars or these things, they have different design goals. Those are all about stability. You know, so basically, I want to wake up and the dollar in my pocket tomorrow is worth kind of the same amount as the dollar in my pocket is today, and I'd like my dollar to be accepted in as many places as possible so I can trade with as many people as possible. Mm-hmm. These utility tokens like Ether or ADA, they are basically a representation of resources in these systems. It's almost like owning oil or something. And you say, oh, okay, well, I have this token and I can use it to do a lot of stuff. It's a fuel for a decentralized economy. So it's almost like a commodity versus a currency type of a debate. So I think that's a more accurate representation of what we're selling.
Like oil, yeah. Or gold?
Yeah, like
soybeans.
Oil. Like oil, but a commodity with utility. So, you know, something that I can actually, like silver would probably be another example, because you can use it in the health industry, and you can use it in wires and for superconductors and so forth. And oil, you put it in an engine. And this is kind of like a decentralized engine, and these units represent basically a percentage control over that system and the ability to influence that system to do certain things, like run computation or store files or something like that.
I have to ask, because I always learn a ton whenever I sit with you and get to talk to you or hear from you. How many books do you read a day? And do you wake up and you read 2 hours, and you wake up at 4, and you read, and then you do you read 20 hours a day? How do you stay on top of all this? And I don't know, obviously you have a really good memory, and then you're also doing all of this great work, and you're traveling, and you have a wonderful family. How does this all work?
So first, traveling does help for reading, because you're always sitting somewhere, right? You're on a plane, and these long haul flights are great opportunities to listen to podcasts and audiobooks and read. The other thing is you teach people, and by teaching you learn. I learned more running my Bitcoin course than I think and I could have ever learned from a book, because I had 50,000 plus students and I got 5,000 emails, and I answered every single one of those emails. It was so time consuming, but it was a great opportunity to really understand what the heck I was talking about. So teaching people things and working with people is just a phenomenal way to retain information. Then you also have to get a nice diverse sampling of books. As a leader and an entrepreneur, all the people who came before me, they wrote down their thoughts. And so I try at least once a month to read one business biography or one business book from a VC guy or a CEO. You have The Everything Store from Jeff Bezos, or Hit Refresh from Satya Nadella. And these people are proven successes. They walked into companies that weren't doing so good, or built a company from nothing, and now it's hundreds of billions of dollars of value. So they've kind of earned a space on my bookshelf. So that's one dimension. Second, I tend to read a lot of historical biographies. Ron Chernow is my favorite author in that respect. And I've read Titan and House of Morgan and the Washington biography. They're very long. They take quite a bit of time to get through, because Chernow is just crazy exhaustive. He's a great historian. But it's nice because it gives you a nice model of a good life. It has all the good elements. It has drama and passion and affairs and failures and chaos. And anybody who's ever done anything at one point in their life has been demonized and deified. And it's really so much fun to read these things, because it gives you some way to kind of think about your own life and say, what parts of my personality or what parts of the things I do are kind of like these people who've come before me. And then I at least then have a model to understand whether what I'm doing makes sense or not. The other thing is you have to develop good cognitive heuristics to handle new information as it comes up. So you can read as many books as you want. You can have great, great eidetic memory and know everything. But if you can't adapt to new things and you don't have good mental models for how to process those things, you'll just make the same mistakes over and over again. For example, the Bush administration was a great example. It's George W. Bush, pretty smart guy, actually. The media made him be an idiotic yokel, but he's an avid reader. He reads about 50 to 100 biographies every year. He's a very bright guy. His biggest issue, though, was that he was very rigid with his mental models. So he tends to take everything from this born-again Christian perspective, and he had kind of a gut way of managing. And when there were decisions to be made that fit well in that framework, he made all those decisions really well. When they fell outside of that framework, he was usually too slow to adapt. And that's why Katrina was so bad, and the 2008 financial crisis wasn't mitigated as well as it could have been. So systems thinking and model thinking and being able to dynamically shift from one thought model to another one is super important. And the good news is actually there's tons of people that are now starting to think about this, about complex adaptive systems. They're starting to think about model thinking, like Scott Page from University of Michigan, for example, wrote a wonderful book called The Model Thinker, and it just will change your life when you read it. Another one's Complex Adaptive Systems that Scott also wrote. These two books alone kind of make you look at the whole world differently. And you say, there is no one version of truth. There's just collections of heuristics that I can adopt, and then I can test them. And if they're not giving me the right answers, then I can kind of hybridize them with other heuristics. And then eventually one of these mental models will be well suited for that particular class of problem that I'm dealing with. We suffer from information overload these days. There's just too much coming at us. And what we say no to, what we drop, what we don't pay attention to is just as meaningful as what we do pay attention to. And how we synthesize these competitive information streams into a holistic whole is actually the key to success in life. Every great CEO has mastered this in one way or another. And every great CEO has not only mastered it, they've mastered the ability to force other people to focus on the right things. For example, Jeff Bezos is legendary for his reading meetings, where, you know, if he has some document he thinks is really important, he'll just print it out and put it in front of all of his executives and say, read this, read it aloud. It's like kindergarten all over again, right? And it forces them to actually read the document. And it focuses everybody in. No cell phones, no talking. Because usually we have these PowerPoint meetings and everybody's not really paying attention. They're all on their cell phones or something. And it was Bezos like, no, he's going to print it out. You're going to read it. So great CEOs, great leaders not only master that skill, then they propagate that skill to everybody around them. And then everybody's on the same mindset and the flow. And then they can collectively work and, you know, build things. So I try to do that as well, you know. So, you know, succinctly, you know, I read at least one biography a month. I try of some historical figure, and it can be, Boyd with OODA loops all the way to, you know, some guy like Ulysses S. Grant. And then I also try to read at least one business memoir a month. And then I look at a diverse portfolio of other things. I think a lot about these days complexity theory and systems thinking and model thinking. And I also try to also read technical things because I like keeping those skills sharp where and when that's possible. And that's the one that suffers the most, actually, unfortunately. I used to read lots of scientific papers and, you know, lots of math things, and I just haven't had the time, and I feel bad about that. I feel like I'm letting myself down or something.
So to go over a couple of words here for, you know, vocab, heuristics, would you say that is, simply put, like a rule of thumb?
Yeah, it's a rule of thumb.
Yeah. It basically, I came across that word reading Thinking Fast and Slow, Dan Kahneman.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then it was like, it's like the word is everywhere in there, and forced me to learn, you know, what it is the hard way.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, it's like that movie, Fly Up in the Air or something. The one with George Clooney in it, where he flies around firing people, and she was complaining that he was stereotyping people, and he said, "I stereotype people because it's just faster that way." You know, it's the ultimate representation of a heuristic. A heuristic is a rule of thumb, and when it's right, it's awesome, and you've massively shortcutted a hard problem. When it's wrong, it's wrong. So collections of heuristics are nice because you can kind of throw all of them quickly at a problem and look at it from different ways. So in mathematics, we have like parity arguments, pigeonhole principle, you know, these types of things, proof by contradiction. So, you know, we say, hey, is this true or false? Well, let me think about it. And I have all these cognitive heuristics that I can use to attack the problem. Well, in society, there's social heuristics you can look at too. You know, for example, if you're in biology, generally speaking, you kind of just think about the evolutionary impacts of things. You say, all right, well, what do I know is true about people who came before? And if what you're telling me violates that, then evolution probably wouldn't select for that. So what you're saying is probably wrong. You know, now, not always. There can be some weird counterexample because it's a heuristic, not a fact. But it is something that helps you kind of sort fact from fiction and understand these mental models.
So the other mention that you made, which I really, really like, I discovered from, I think it was Reid Hoffman, his podcast. But you said OODA loop.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's observe,
orient,
decide,
action.
And action.
Right.
Right, exactly. From fighter pilots.
Yeah, from a fighter pilot. Yeah, he was a legendary fighter pilot, and he did a lot of test fighting, and he was a brilliant strategic thinker, but he was kind of a firebrand, and so as a consequence, he couldn't rise to the highest echelons of the military, but everybody liked him, so they let him make big decisions. And for example, he had a lot to do with some of our initial strategy for the Gulf War conflict, and saved probably tens of thousands of lives as a consequence. But it's just basically situational awareness. It's about looking at the world around you and having a model that you use to be able to instantly capture as quickly as you can what's actually going on, orient your mind in a way where you can actually make a decision about it, and then figure out what your action plan is going to be. And then you have a feedback loop within the system where you want to fail fast as quickly as you can. So this is the original lean startup, you know, fail as quickly as you can, fail fast, fail often. Because in a military setting, you have these tactics and strategies, you have these beautiful plans that you construct, then you start executing them, and everybody in the field in that moment have to actually suck everything in and say, are we following the plan? Is everything going according to plan? How is the enemy reacting to the plan? And so forth. And so you need a mental system that allows you to do that. And it's quite useful in business because, you know, I make a business strategy every year, and I have assumptions and inputs that go into that strategy. And when they're true and everything looks great, okay, you know, we're really rich, private jets for everybody. But when it goes wrong, how do you fix that? And when do you know that it's just, you know, momentum and it's going to take time to work? And when do you know you're actually wrong? That's really the hardest part of leadership in business, is when do you give up on your ideas and pivot versus just saying that, oh, my ideas are right and sound, the timing is just not right, and I need some momentum to get them done.
You're wrong. Right. That's the joke in investing.
Yeah, exactly, right? You can be right, and you can be right, and know the difference between the two.
So that perfectly aligns with kind of like landing this plane right here, but Aerie's going to play poker at the Mike Tyson Mansion tomorrow.
Ooh.
The reason I bring that up is because, you know, his joke, maybe, you know, others made it before, but it's like, everybody comes into the ring with a plan until I punch him in the face, and then they gotta figure out a new plan, right then.
Right. It's like, man, that punch hurt.
Exactly. You can't think of anything else.
Right, we didn't plan for the massive price appreciation in 2017, and we certainly didn't plan for it to collapse the way it did. We kind of had some suspicions it was going to do that, because nothing grows to the sky forever. But it's really hard. But that's what makes it fun too. You know, if you're wrong, you know, being able to recover from that, get back on your feet. Like Microsoft is a great example of that. They dominated in the 80s and 90s. They were so powerful that they just kind of sucked all the wind out of everything. Then in the 2000s, they just bet wrong and missed huge things like mobile computing and search and social media. And then everybody said, oh, Microsoft's gone. They can't do anything. And now they're back, and they're back with a vengeance. Surface is just probably going to outsell Apple devices
cloud,
at some point.
Azure
is just a behemoth,
massive,
you know.
Yeah.
So they were able to come back into the ring and come back convincingly. And then you look at Google or Facebook or these other, you know, massive companies that seem to have unassailable monopolies, and then you say to yourself, how many small mistakes would they have to make, or strategic missteps or timing issues would they have to make where they're no longer like that? And it's surprisingly few, you'd think. You know, like Microsoft knew in the 90s about social media and search and mobile computing. They even had this famous memo that went to Bill Gates that said, this is what the next decade is going to look like. And they predicted the rise of Facebook and Google and so forth. And Bill read it and he said, yeah, this is a good idea. They just had the wrong strategy. For example, they thought something like the iPhone would come out in 2009, not 2007, because they'd been charting Moore's Law and these other things, and they said it's just not feasible to do a $600 phone to the consumer at this point. We have to wait for it to be about a $300 to $400 phone and for cell infrastructure to get better. What Steve did is he had business model innovation. He found a way to sell a $600 phone for $200, and he found a way to twist AT&T's arm to get their infrastructure better, and those two factors allowed them to leapfrog the market and have a two-year advantage over Microsoft's strategy. And they just crushed BlackBerry and all these other incumbents who were betting on that 2009 point for smartphones. So these are examples of where you can know the future, but it still doesn't matter. You can't execute fast enough.
Well, we got to land the plane for real now. But Charles, every time I get to hear you and see your family and your team, it's always amazing. I'm always so impressed to be a part of the journey. What can our audience do to stay in touch with you? And
how do they find you?
My Twitter feed is probably the best way of communicating with me, IOHK_Charles. There's probably several fake accounts, so join the one that has the most followers. That's probably the right one.
That's right.
They won't give me a blue check mark, unfortunately, so I that's all I can say.
Cool. Well, I really appreciate
your
Charles. Time. And thank you to our listeners and our audience for coming along with us on this journey. And thank you to our sponsors, CoinMe, Fresh Chalk, and the WTIA, for our opportunity to share these stories with the Pacific Northwest region and beyond.
And the world.
And don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, and share.
Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And we're out.
Hi, y'all. This is Dora from Detroit. None of the statements or opinions expressed in this podcast by the guest or its host is to be taken as financial or legal or psychological or dietary advice or a solicitation of any kind to participate in a conservative or risky or speculative financial instrument that may or may not require accredited investor status as defined by either the Securities and Exchange Commission or the Commodity Futures Trading Commission or any other regulatory agency of the United States of America or any other sovereign national regulatory agency or independent thought and rational thinking from the laws of humanity. By listening, you acknowledge that the hosts, Ari and Day, and their guests are not financial advisors or legal scholars or psychologists or dietitians of any kind, but only humans and not sentient intergalactic alien life forms. There shall be no reliance by the listeners to the representations made in this podcast as being factual, fiduciary, or any other big vocabulary word you can think of. All statements made in this podcast by any living or dead or unborn or zombie or robotic entity in the past, present, or future of the space-time continuum of the known universe are purely ironic or coincidental thoughts and opinions. Moments or observations of sarcasm, sadness, glee, education, entertainment, enlightenment, or any other enumerated emotion and or reaction experienced from this podcast are fully your responsibility and reaction that may or may not be intended for the listener in any way, shape, or form. This podcast contains adult information. Discretion is strongly advised. Thank you for listening.
Charles Hoskinson reporting live from warm, sunny Las Vegas. And we're joined.
Sitting in the Coin Agenda.
We're sitting in Coin Agenda with the great Tamara Hassan. Of course, we have Ariu and her good friend Day.
Yes. Friends with benefits. And children.
The kind of friend that gets half your stuff if he's no longer your friend. Okay.
It's okay. We're hot.
Yeah. Absolutely. Not, not
you
takes.
Said it. Yeah.
Right, there we go.
So remember,
trust me, in 20 years that B-roll is going to be worth a lot of money.
Those the audience is working people, parents, non-technical people.
Okay. Okay.
Jane, school teacher.
All right, let's explain how quantum entanglement works.
Perfect.
Okay.
Your phaser right there, it's on stun?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
Ahead of the game.
Ahead of the game. Always prepared. Work by plan. Think ahead. Mm-hmm. Plan ahead. Mm-hmm. Action ahead.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Hi, y'all.